This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Science News. We'll explore the latest research and the intersection of science and society. There's always something fascinating to learn in Science News, coming up next on the audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Science News, and I'm your reader, Bill Shaw, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from the Science News website, and now I'll begin with, and now from the News of Health and Medicine, immune cells' intense reaction to the coronavirus may lead to pneumonia. The virus appears to target macrophages that reside in the lung tissue. By Amy Cunningham. The intense reaction of one of the lung's guardians against infection may help explain why COVID-19 can become severe. The guardian's immune cells, called interstitial macrophages, patrol lung tissue. These cells can be infected in a big way by SARS-CoV-2. Researchers report online April 10th in the Journal of Experimental Medicine. Overwhelmed by the virus onslaught, the cell's extreme inflammatory response may contribute to the development of pneumonia, a disease that damages the lungs and makes breathing difficult. Quote, there is this gap in our knowledge of how human lung tissue really responds in the earliest phases of a SARS-CoV-2 infection, says Jose Ordovas Montañas, an immunologist at Boston Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School who was not involved in the research. The new work has, quote, put a spotlight, end quote, on interstitial macrophages' role, he says. Quote, I think this is an interesting piece of the puzzle, end quote. A bout of COVID-19 can begin after someone breathes in the coronavirus, which, launched by a sneeze or a cough, spreads through the air. Evidence suggests the virus first infects cells that line the nasal cavity or the throat, and then the immune system response kicks in. From that point, many people clear the infection, says Catherine Blish, a viral immunologist at Stanford University School of Medicine. But some don't, and the virus can spread into the airways of the lungs and infect cells lining the air sacs, the structures where oxygen and carbon dioxide are exchanged. Blish and her colleagues wanted to investigate the next steps of a coronavirus infection in the lungs and what might drive the progression to pneumonia. The team worked with thin slices of human lung tissue procured from organ donations or surgeries in which some of the tissue needed to be removed. The researchers exposed the tissue to SARS-CoV-2 to see which cells became infected. Quote, it was really no contest, Blish says. The vast majority were macrophages, immune cells that take up viruses and other pathogens and, quote, eat, end quote, them in order to present the parts to other immune cells. This helps activate the body's immune response. Specifically, there were two types of macrophages, those that reside in the lung tissue called interstitial and those associated with the air sacs. The researchers took purified macrophages of each type and put them in a dish with SARS-CoV-2 for additional experiments to show that the cells were being infected, not just gobbling up virus. The team also probed the immune response of the two populations of macrophages Those that reside in the lungs' air sacs weren't as dominated by the virus and produced a proportionate inflammatory response. But the coronavirus was able to take over the cellular machinery of the interstitial macrophages. The team found that in response, these macrophages ramped up their production of proteins that target viruses and call in other immune cells. The cells are, quote, sending massive alarm signals. There's an invader. Danger, danger, Blish says. In the body, this kind of immune response can lead to a huge influx of cells and inflammatory proteins into the lungs' airspace, Blish says. That can compromise the air sac's ability to function and help set the stage for pneumonia. Blish and colleagues also found that SARS-CoV-2 enters the interstitial macrophages through a different receptor than the very well-known entry point for other cells. This may help explain why treatments that target ACE2 haven't worked well for severe pneumonia, Blish says. Experiments with lung slices can't exactly replicate what's going on in the body. The study doesn't answer how the virus would get into the lung tissue and gain access to the interstitial macrophages, Blish says. Quote, it's a sensible model to put forward, Ordovas Montañez says. But with the lung slices, quote, you give equal chance to any cell that was either on the outside part or on the inside part of the lung, end quote, to become infected. It may be helpful to complement this research with studies in animal models in which the lung's physiology is intact, he says, although those types of studies also don't exactly translate to what's happening in people. Quote, each model is going to give you a slightly skewed view of reality, end quote. And now I have from the news of health and medicine. Teens are using an unregulated form of THC. Here's what we know. A legal loophole makes Delta 8 easily accessible for high schoolers, by Helen Bradshaw. Walk into a gas station in the United States and you may see more than just boxes of cigarettes lining the back wall. Colorful containers containing Delta 8, a form of the substance THC, are sold in gas stations and shops across the country, and teens are buying them. A recent survey of more than 2,000 U.S. high school seniors found that more than 11% of them had used Delta 8 in the past year. Researchers report March 18th in JAMA. This is the first year the Monitoring the Future study, one of the leading nationally representative surveys of drug use trends among adolescents in the United States, looked at Delta 8 use. Because more than 1 in 10 senior students said they use the drug, the survey team plans to monitor Delta 8 use every year going forward. Quote, we don't really want to see any kids being exposed to cannabis because it potentially increases the risk for developmental harms and some psychiatric reactions, end quote, such as suicidal thoughts, says Alyssa Harlow, a researcher on the survey and an epidemiologist at the University of Southern California, Keck School of Medicine in Los Angeles. Despite its prevalence, especially in the South and Midwest, Delta 8 is still new to consumers and research. Science News talked with Harlow and addiction researcher Jessica Kruger of the University of Buffalo in New York to help explain the Delta 8 craze and its effects on kids. What is Delta 8 THC? Cannabis plants contain over 100 compounds known as cannabinoids. Delta 8 is one of them. The most well-known is Delta 9 tetrahydrocannabinol, or Delta 9 THC. Delta 9 is the primary molecule responsible for getting people high when they consume marijuana. That's because the human brain has cannabinoid receptors that help regulate appetite, mood, memory, and other physiological roles. These receptors aren't designed to interact with cannabis plants. They're meant to interact with endocannabinoids, which are naturally produced in our bodies, but cannabinoids from cannabis plants can still bind to these receptors and commandeer their normal functioning system. The chemical structure of molecules of delta-9 and delta-8 THC are very similar. The only difference is the location of a double bond between carbon atoms. Because of this change, delta-8 doesn't bind as easily to cannabinoid receptors in our brain, making it somewhat less potent than delta-9. But delta-8 does still bind to those receptors. It is still THC, and it still has psychoactive effects. Unlike delta-9, delta-8 is found only in small amounts in cannabis plants, so it's usually chemically synthesized from other cannabinoids like CBD. Quote, they're putting different chemicals in other cannabinoids to create delta-8 from a naturally occurring substance, Kruger says. Quote, it often contains harmful additives and byproducts, much of which is unknown, end quote. Why is delta-8 not regulated by the government? In 2018, the Farm Bill became federal law. It took hemp products, which come from the same plant as marijuana, off the federal controlled substances list. Hemp became legal so long as each hemp product contained less than 0.3% THC based on dry weight. But the bill's language specified 0.3% delta-9 THC, not all THC, leaving a loophole for production and unregulated sale of delta-8 products. Quote, people tend not to smoke delta-8, Kruger says, even though they can. Quote, people describe it as feeling very harsh on their lungs. We tend to see this in tinctures and edibles. But I'm starting to see more vape cartridges, too, end quote. Why does delta-8 appeal to teens? Because of the legal loophole in the Farm Bill, there's very little regulation of delta-8. Quote, there's no federal minimum purchasing age for delta-8 and other hemp-derived THC products, Harlow says. Quote, and they're being sold in stores that are frequented by youth, often without age verification. These accessible places include gas stations and online retailers. Quote, you go to a gas station, Kruger says, and the person selling it doesn't really know what it is, and it's right on the counter. There's nothing stopping adolescents, end quote. Beyond access. The packaging and social media marketing of delta-8 products target teens, quote, because there's no regulation, Harlow says. Quote, you'll see delta-8 products that are emulating very well-known candy and food products, end quote. Or as Kruger notes, quote, the cannabis industry is definitely taking some pages out of the tobacco playbook, end quote. What effects does delta-8 have? In her own research, Kruger found that delta-8 tends to be, quote, a nicer, younger sibling of delta-9, she says. Quote, people tend to say that it's not as strong, and they don't get as much anxiety from it, and they also have a little bit more clear-headedness as they're using it, end quote. But she says it's important to recognize that while these might be trends, these feelings aren't absolute guarantees. Side effects include vomiting, hallucinations, loss of consciousness, and anxiety, according to adverse effects reports made to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Why are public health officials worried about delta-8? End quote. THC, including delta-8, can be dangerous for anyone, but especially kids. It's associated with depression, thoughts of suicide, and schizophrenia. One study also found kids who used THC experienced a faster than normal thinning of the prefrontal cortex, which is important for problem solving and emotional regulation. All THC can increase a kid's risk for developmental harms, but delta-8 also poses unique risks when compared with regular marijuana, Harlow says. Because only a few states have enacted legislation for delta-8, it's usually not a requirement to clearly label that the products contain THC or the levels of it, she says. Quote, so there's the concern that young people could be taking these products thinking, oh, this is a hemp product, and just not knowing that there's THC in it. End quote. Unclear labeling and imprecise dosage instructions can lead to dangerous amounts of THC in the body. And with the possible presence of contaminants from chemical synthesis, Delta 8 products may contain more than meets the eye. Quote, I really worry about these contaminants, Kruger says. Quote, I worry that they're actually getting something different, and I worry about the potency. End quote. Reports of negative reactions to Delta 8 have increased too. In 2022, America's Poison Centers, a group of 55 poison centers across the United States, managed over 3,000 cases of Delta 8 use, an 82% increase from the year before. These factors have led government agencies like the FDA to issue warnings about Delta 8. Given the survey results, what's next? To Harlow, this survey was a temperature check to see if Delta 8 use in teens was something to pay attention to. Now her team knows it is, and she says they have unanswered questions they plan to address in future surveys. Quote, what type of products are teens using? Where are they purchasing them? Are they getting them online? Are they getting them from friends? Are they getting them from stores that are not checking IDs? Harlow and her team's survey shows preliminary evidence that Delta 8 use is lower in states that have adopted legislation for the cannabinoid, but they can't definitively say that legislation is why use is lower in these areas. Legalization of Delta 9, however, seems to curtail Delta 8 use, Kruger says. Quote, as there becomes a more regulated market for cannabis products, people tend to move to that more regulated market, end quote. In areas like the South, where Harlow's team found heightened Delta 8 use, Kruger worries about the future of THC products. Quote, I don't think some of these states will maybe ever legalize until there's federal legislation, or maybe not even then, she says. Quote, I really worry about the risk of these alternative cannabinoids because a lot of them are very untested, very unregulated, very unsteady. End quote. Now we have some news from space. How a sugar acid crucial for life could have formed in interstellar clouds. Glyceric acid has been found in meteorites. New lab experiments hint at its origin in space by Saugat Bolakhe. Researchers may have figured out how a crucial ingredient that cells need to produce energy could form in deep space. Calculations and lab experiments suggest that glyceric acid can arise from radiation blasting carbon dioxide and ethylene glycol in interstellar clouds, researchers report in the March 15th Science Advances. The study is, quote, a great start to understand how these molecules are formed in space, says Anthony Remijan, an astrochemist at the National Radioastronomy Observatory in Charlottesville, Virginia, who was not involved in the research. The findings suggest that, quote, if you put the right mixture together in the right conditions, maybe you can even afford more complex molecules in space, he says. Glyceric acid plays an important role in cell metabolism, energy balance, and photosynthesis, and it can go on to help form other complex molecules important for life. The acidic sugar has previously been found in meteorites, suggesting that it can form in outer space. Astronomers have yet to directly observe glyceric acid in space, but they suspect it may form in interstellar clouds, such as the Orion Nebula, which roils with gas, plasma, and dust. Telescope observations alone can't decipher how an organic compound forms in space, but astronomers can identify what gases are present in interstellar clouds. And chemists can predict what happens to those gases when blasted with radiation. That approach has led scientists to demonstrate how, for example, the simple sugar, ribose, could be made in simulated interstellar conditions. So the new study began with a principal question, quote, can we synthesize glyceric acid at low temperature and low pressure like we get in space, says Ryan Fortenberry, a theoretical astrochemist at the University of Mississippi near Oxford. Quote, we think we can, end quote. Fortenberry and colleagues started by looking into the properties of two compounds that are abundant in interstellar clouds, carbon dioxide and ethylene glycol, commonly known as the active ingredient in antifreeze. Computer calculations of how CO2 and ethylene glycol respond to radiation suggest that they could team up to form glyceric acid in space. To verify the theoretical results, physical chemist Ralph Ingo Kaiser of the University of Hawaii at Manoa and colleagues deposited ices of carbon dioxide and ethylene glycol in a vacuum chamber at extremely low pressure and temperature. The team then blasted the compounds with radiation. Quote, we cannot generate galactic cosmic rays in our lab, Kaiser says, so they opted for the next best thing, spraying the compounds with electrons to simulate the shower of charged particles that's triggered when cosmic rays hit ice. As the ices transition to vapors, the team further blasted the chamber with ultraviolet radiation, which resulted in the formation of glyceric acid molecules. Quote, it's not magic, Fortenberry says. Quote, but it feels like magic because you get these biologically significant species that really mind-blowingly simple molecules. Because you get these biologically significant species from really mind-blowingly simple molecules, end quote. While simple organic molecules are easy to observe in many cosmic environments, complex organics are harder to find. The study provides an understanding into, quote, how much that very simple chemistry that we can observe can evolve into something more complex, says Stephanie Melam, an astrochemist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. A next step, Fortenberry's team says, is to search interstellar clouds for glyceric acid. Astronomers could use the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array in Chile, which has helped find phosphorus-bearing molecules and others important for life in the cosmos. And now we have from the news of artificial intelligence. This robot can tell when you're about to smile and smile back. Emo can predict a human smile 839 milliseconds before it happens, by Helen Bradshaw. With its hairless silicone skin and blue complexion, Emo the robot looks more like a mechanical recreation of the Blue Man Group than a regular human until it smiles. In a study published March 27th in Science Robotics, researchers detail how they trained Emo to smile in sync with humans. Emo can predict a human smile 839 milliseconds before it happens and smile back. Right now, in most humanoid robots, there's a noticeable delay before they can smile back at a person, often because the robots are imitating a person's face in real time. Quote, I think a lot of people actually interacting with a social robot for the first time are disappointed by how limited it is, says Cheona Chen, a human-robot interaction researcher at the University of Glasgow in Scotland. Quote, improving robots' expressions in real time is important, end quote. Through synced facial expressions, future iterations of robots could be sources of connection in our loneliness epidemic, says Yuhang Hu, a roboticist at Columbia University who, along with colleagues, created Emo. Cameras in the robot's eyes let it detect subtleties in human expressions that it then emulates using 26 actuators underneath its soft blue face. To train Emo, the researchers first put it in front of a camera for a few hours, like looking in a mirror would do for humans and their muscles, looking at itself in the camera. While researchers ran random motor commands on the actuators, helped Emo learn the relationships between activating actuators in its face and the expressions it created. Quote, then the robot knows, okay, if I want to make a smiley face, I should actuate these muscles, who says. Next, the researchers played videos of humans making facial expressions. By analyzing nearly 800 videos, Emo could learn what muscle movement indicated which expressions were about to occur. In thousands of further tests with hundreds of other videos, the robot could correctly predict what facial expression a human would make and recreate it in sync with the human more than 70% of the time. Beyond smiling, Emo can create expressions that involve raising the eyebrows and frowning, who says the robot's timely smiles could relieve some of the awkward and eerie feelings that delayed reactions in robots can cause. Emo's blue skin, too, was designed to help it avoid the uncanny valley effect. If people think a robot is supposed to look like a human, quote, then they will always find some difference or become skeptical, who says. Instead, with Emo's rubbery blue face, people can, quote, think about it as a new species. It doesn't have to be a real person, end quote. The robot has no voice right now, but integrating generative AI chatbot functionalities like those of ChatGPT into Emo could create even more apt reactions in the robot. Emo would be able to anticipate facial reactions from words in addition to human muscle movement. Then the robot could respond verbally too. First, though, Emo's lips need some work. Current robot mouth movement often relies on the jaw to do all the talking, not the lips. Quote, people immediately lose interest and it's really weird, who says. Once the robot has more realistic lips and chatbot capabilities, it could be a better companion. Having Emo as company on late nights in the robotics lab would be a welcome addition, who says, quote, maybe when I'm working at midnight, we can complain to each other about why there's so much work or tell a few jokes, who says. Moving right along to the news of animals. Hibernating bumblebee queens have a superpower, surviving for days underwater. Being submerged for a week didn't put a damper on survival, suggesting a resilience to floods, by Darren Incorvai. It's not easy being a queen, a bumblebee queen that is. To start her colony in the spring, an expectant queen must first survive the winter by hibernating alone in the soil, where she's vulnerable to hazards like floods. It turns out these bee queens are royally up to the task. In a serendipitous discovery, researchers have found that hibernating bumblebee queens can survive being submerged in water for up to a week. Bee biologists Sabrina Rondo and Nigel Rain were studying how hibernating queens respond to pesticide exposure, condensation in the refrigerator storing the dormant bees in Rain's lab at the University of Guelph in Canada accidentally caused four of the vials housing queens to flood. The pair describe April 17th in biology letters. Quote, I was very concerned at first, says Rondo, now at the University of Ottawa. Quote, I thought, of course, they were dead. End quote. But to her great surprise, when she picked the queens up with forceps, they started fidgeting, undeniably alive. Rondo and Rain decided to test more rigorously just how waterproof bumblebee queens are. They gathered 143 common eastern bumblebee queens, left over from another experiment. These bees are available commercially and weren't collected from the wild. 17 queens served as controls and weren't submerged underwater, while the others were either submerged or left floating on the water surface for either 8 hours, 24 hours, or 1 week. All the bees were housed in individual vials and stored at cold hibernation temperatures. This was meant to mimic possible real-world flooding scenarios where a queen's hibernation chamber could potentially be filled with water or only partially submerged. How often that happens is unknown. Observations of bumblebees overwintering in the wild are scarce, but queens have been found to generally prefer sloped ground and sandy soils that would not be prone to flooding. Even so, it seems the insects are prepared for disaster. It turned out that the four queens who survived accidental fridge flooding were hardly outliers. Of the 21 queens that were submerged for 7 days and then allowed to resume hibernating, 17 were still alive 8 weeks after their aquatic ordeal. This rate of survival was not statistically different from that of the 17 bees that were never submerged. 15 of them survived to 8 weeks. When first pulling the queens out of the water, Rondo says they looked like a bee that you'd fish out of a swimming pool. But after a day back in the refrigerator, quote, they are fluffy again, beautiful, like nothing happened, she says, quote, extremely surprising, end quote. The finding raises many more questions. Rain says, quote, does it affect their ability to found colonies? Does it affect reproductive success of the colony, end quote. There's also the question of how the queens managed to survive being underwater for so long. Many adult insects have adaptations to help them avoid drowning, like closing their spiracles, the body openings they breathe through to prevent water from getting in. Rondo suspects that the lowered metabolism of hibernating queens also helps, as they can go longer with their spiracles closed than they could if they were fully awake and active. Quote, what it really shows is how little we know and how much there is to learn about the bumblebee life cycle, says Elizabeth Crone, a biologist at the University of California, Davis. Quote, their interactions with flowers are one of the best studied phenomena in ecology. In contrast, we know very little about their nesting, hibernation, and reproduction, end quote. And now we have from the news of life. This marine alga is the first known eukaryote to pull nitrogen from the air. Until now, the only nitrogen-fixing organisms were thought to be prokaryotes, such as bacteria, by Jake Bueller. It's time to welcome a new type of cell to the club of living things that can harvest nitrogen from the atmosphere. Until now, the only life forms thought to pull nitrogen from the air and turn it into a biologically useful form were bacteria and archaea. But the discovery of a special ammonia factory inside a single-celled ocean alga adds eukaryotes, organisms with membrane-bound structures called organelles, to the list. Researchers report in the April 12th Science. That factory, the scientists say, was once a bacterium that started living inside the alga about 100 million years ago and has since evolved into a nitrogen-harvesting machine for its host. Once a symbiont, it's now one of the cell's many organelles. Nitrogen fixation, where atmospheric nitrogen gas is converted into ammonia, is an important process for life. Organisms require access to nitrogen-containing compounds to synthesize essential biochemicals. The bacteria and archaea that have this ability often work their gas refining in soil or in aquatic environments like the ocean. One such bacteria, dubbed UCYN-A, A, is widely distributed in the world's oceans and is important to oceanic nitrogen fixation, says marine ecologist Jonathan Zer of the University of California, Santa Cruz. These bacteria are also known to be symbionts living within the unicellular algae, Brachydosphera bigelowi, and its relatives. However, the line between symbiont and organelle can be fuzzy. Zer and colleagues set out to better understand where UCYN-A falls on that spectrum. Using X-ray imaging, the team first learned that when the algal cells divide, all its organelles arrange themselves in a line and take turns dividing in a well-defined sequence. Quote, this symbiont participates in that sequence, says marine biologist Tyler Cole, also of UC Santa Cruz. Quote, it's somehow getting the cue to divide right on time with the other organelles, end quote. Next, the researchers analyzed the full sets of genetic instructions and proteins, the genomes and proteomes made by the algae and the USIN-A symbionts. Quote, about half of the proteins that are physically present inside this symbiont are derived from the host genome, Cole says. These supplemental proteins appear to fill gaps in the bacterium's crucial metabolic pathways, suggesting it relies on the algal cells' proteins to function. In line with this, many of the bacterial proteins harbor special amino acid chains. Molecular biologist Jarn Archibald, who did not participate in the work, describes them as, quote, postage stamps, end quote, for trafficking proteins within the cell. A similar system exists for routing proteins that are encoded by the host cell's genome into mitochondria and chloroplasts, organelles thought to have evolved from symbiotic microbes. Quote, the data clearly show that the two cells have been co-evolving for some time, says Archibald of Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. The researchers argue that all these features show USIN-A isn't merely a symbiont, but has evolved into an organelle, the nitroplast. Quote, protein import is really the smoking gun, says Oliver Caspari, a molecular biologist at the University of Bonn in Germany, who is not involved with the study. That import implies a degree of interdependence that marks the bacterium as an organelle, he says. The nitroplast is one of just four known instances of symbiotic microbes evolving into cogs in a host's cellular machinery. In particular, chloroplasts and mitochondria evolved from microbial symbionts as much as 2 billion years ago. Previous research on the evolutionary history of USIN-A showed its relationship with algae is far more recent, around 100 million years old. That means nitroplasts may provide a snapshot of how mitochondria and chloroplasts evolved into organelles. Researchers have long thought that this process involves symbiont genomes migrating into the nuclear genome of the host, but there doesn't seem to be evidence of this in the nitroplast, Cole says. Instead, the host genome may support the symbiont to the point that the symbiont's own genome withers away. Quote, if genes are targeted and their proteins are imported into these organelles, then their genomes are free to lose those genes, Cole says. Quote, maybe this is the mechanism by which symbionts are domesticated, end quote. Health and medicine news next. What can period blood reveal about a person's health? The FDA recently approved the first diagnostic test based on menstrual blood by Payal Dar. When you think of getting tested for a disease, you might think first of nasal swabs, urine tests, blood draws. Even though around 1.8 billion people across the world menstruate, period blood doesn't come to mind. But that might soon change. Earlier this year, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, for the first time, approved a health test based on period blood. The at-home test, which detects a biomarker for diabetes, offers an alternative to the blood draws typically required to diagnose the disease. It's also a first step in a long-term vision for researchers, Sarah Nasseri, CEO and co-founder of QVIN, the San Francisco Bay Area-based company that makes the test. Quote, "Women bleed every month, so why let that go to waste?" Nasseri remembers wondering a decade ago as a medical student. Period blood, she thought, could be a convenient way to get clues to a person's health. No needles required. When she couldn't find much research on the approach, she decided to look into it herself. Then at Stanford University School of Medicine, she and her colleagues found that, quote, "Menstrual blood is in fact blood," she says, and, quote, "essential health information can be gleaned from it," end quote. That preliminary study, reported in 2019, compared samples of menstrual blood with blood that circulates through the body from 20 women over 2 months. The team concluded that menstrual blood could reliably estimate levels of several biomarkers, including for diabetes and inflammation, as well as reproductive hormones, and so could be an alternative source for diagnosis and health monitoring. Since then, Nasseri and colleagues have further tested menstrual blood for diabetes diagnosis specifically and studied whether types of human papillomavirus that put a person at a high risk for cervical cancer can be detected in the blood. But anthropologist Catherine Clancy says it's too early to be rolling out products based on menstrual blood testing. She researches women's health, endometrial function, and evolutionary medicine at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and is author of the book, Period, The Real Story of Menstruation. Menstrual blood is super interesting, but it looks like the only test that they'll be able to do is A1C, end quote, which measures average glucose levels in the blood. And that test, she points out, quote, is very easily done with a regular blood test, end quote. For now, Clancy would like to see more effort and money put into the still nascent research, which is what will best serve people's needs. At the same time, she's intrigued by the idea of using menstrual blood for medical tests. Testing for diabetes is a good place to start. What is the QPAD? Estimates suggest that almost 40 million people in the United States have diabetes, with just under 9 million of them undiagnosed. Many others have elevated blood sugar levels that fall just below where diabetes can be diagnosed and are unaware of it, says physician Kathleen Jordan, who specializes in women's health care. She is chief medical officer of the telehealth provider Midi Health, based in Menlo Park, California. Diabetes causes more than 100,000 deaths every year in the United States and about 1.5 million globally. Complications from diabetes include disorders of the eyes, kidneys, nervous system, and heart, and increased risk of stroke, which can all be prevented with early diagnosis and treatment. Quote, "I think more people need to get tested, period," Jordan says. Diabetes is easy to diagnose using a hemoglobin A1C test, which reflects the average blood sugar level over the 2 to 3 months leading up to the test. It requires a blood draw by a trained technician, but no fasting or other prep from the patient. QVIN's do-it-yourself option, called the QPAD Test Kit, has two special menstrual pads with removable collection strips. After collections during one menstrual cycle, both strips are mailed to a certified laboratory for testing. Results arrive via app or email. Quote, "The reliability is excellent and it correlates with serum blood testing," Jordan says. "There's also a strong correlation between diabetes and polycystic ovary syndrome, or PCOS, which causes irregular periods and infertility. The A1C biomarker could aid in the the diagnosis of both. Jordan says, quote, it offers a solution for people whose barrier to getting tested may be needle phobia, end quote. There are some downsides, though. At a cost of $49, the test might not be affordable for everyone. It doesn't require a prescription, but insurance doesn't pay for it. And its reported results are not yet integrated into existing medical records systems. Because it's new, Jordan says, clinicians will probably retest with a traditional blood draw to confirm a diagnosis. How does period blood differ from regular blood? Doctors have been relying on blood tests to assess patients' health for almost three quarters of a century. Today, hundreds of biomarkers present in the blood offer a window into our well-being, from nutrient deficiencies to signs of cancer. Menstrual effluent, the cells and tissue from the thickened endometrial lining of the uterus that are shed every cycle, is far more complex than blood from the veins or arteries. It does contain blood that you would get from a blood draw from other parts of the body, but it also has proteins, hormones, and bacteria that are specific to the uterus. One study identified more than 1,000 proteins in menstrual effluent. Of those, 385 are found exclusively in period blood and not in circulating blood or vaginal fluid. And there may be other stuff we don't fully know about, Clancy says. Research on menstrual blood, she says, is, quote, so young that we've barely characterized everything that's in it, end quote. What is the potential of period blood testing? For now, the period blood test has been approved only for diabetes, but Nasseri sees far greater potential. Her list includes testing for C-reactive protein, a marker for inflammation, reproductive hormones, which can signal fertility or menopause, thyroid hormones for clues to thyroid health, and even antibodies that indicate an immune response to SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. All these markers are present and already tested for in circulating blood. The extra components in period blood present additional opportunities. The same study that analyzed the proteins in menstrual blood also identified markers of uterine infertility. Detecting those markers would otherwise require uterine flushing, X-rays, or other imaging tests. Cell populations in menstrual effluent could help diagnose endometriosis, which usually requires a physical exam, ultrasound, MRI, and sometimes invasive procedures like a biopsy or even surgery. Similarly, types of human papillomavirus that comes with a high risk of cervical cancer can be detected in period blood versus the traditional pap smear. A company called The Blood, co-founded by entrepreneurs Miriam Santer and Isabella Guineau in Germany, plans to develop a menstrual blood collection and testing product that would cover a wider array of health indicators, including biomarkers for PCOS, endometriosis, and the early detection of cancer. It would also make health recommendations based on not just those biomarkers, but also a person's cycle, nutrition, lifestyle, and any reported physical and mental symptoms, quote, more like a holistic health approach, but with a very specific blood analysis, Santer says. An early version of the product called Cycle Check, that doesn't yet include any biomarker analysis is on the market. It evaluates the color, viscosity, and other physical properties of period blood, which the company claims, quote, helps you to understand how to optimize your diet, exercise, and lifestyle choices to increase your menstrual health and well-being, end quote. Santer is hoping the requisite approvals and certifications for biomarker analysis come through by year end. Quote, on the side, we're also investing in research for novel biomarker detection, Santer says, including conducting clinical studies that compare biomarkers, reproductive hormones, and vitamins in menstrual versus circulating blood. The blood is also exploring whether stem cells are present in period secretions. What are the challenges? One of the big challenges of using menstrual blood is that it hasn't been tested and evaluated for diagnostics and therapeutics in the same way other blood has. Nasseri and her colleagues pointed out in their 2019 study. There's a lot more basic science needed, Clancy says. One open question is whether any particular menstrual blood value represents a moment in time or some accumulation. How period blood might vary at different points during menses or between individuals has not been properly studied yet, she adds. Another challenge is preventing the deterioration of menstrual effluent samples once blood contacts air. Microbes start acting on it. Techniques have been developed to stabilize samples drawn from veins or arteries, but menstrual blood deteriorates faster. The reason so many questions remain is simple, Santer says, quote, we've just not been focusing on women's health in general. There's not enough basic understanding of the woman's body, how we're affected by specific diseases, how we react to medication, therapeutics, and so on, end quote. It wasn't until last year, for example, that period products such as cups, discs, pads, and underwear were tested with actual blood, though not even menstrual blood for the first time. The research studied the absorbency and red blood cell capacity of period products to better assess heavy menstrual bleeding. Quote, speaking about menstruation openly is still taboo for a lot of people, Santer says. And now from the news of animals, this newfound longhorn beetle species is unusually fluffy. Whitish hairs and other unique physical traits set the beetle apart from other longhorns. By Saugat Bolhake, meet Excastra albopilosa, a newly identified species of longhorn beetle that rocks an unusually fluffy white coat. Discovered in Australia, the fuzzy-looking arthropod also has distinct separated eye lobes, short antennal segments, and unique variations in the shapes of its legs. All these factors suggest the beetle may warrant being classified as its own genetic family or genus. Researchers report March 19th in the Australian Journal of Taxonomy. Roughly 18,000 species of all kinds are discovered each year, at least half of which are insects. Quote, I'm actually surprised that this species had not been discovered before, says Menno Schilthoutsen, an evolutionary biologist at Taxon Expeditions in Leiden, Netherlands, who was not involved in the study. The visually striking beetle, measuring nearly a centimeter in length, was found in a popular area among longhorn beetle enthusiasts. While staying at an eco lodge near Lamington National Park in Queensland, entomologist James Tweed had stepped out to brush his teeth when he stumbled across, quote, some white thing, end quote, hanging on a long and narrow leaf of basket grass. Upon closer inspection, Tweed suspected the thing might be a type of longhorn beetle. He snapped a photo and uploaded it to iNaturalist, an app that helps people identify organisms. Other app users couldn't identify it. Neither could the senior beetle experts at the Australian National Insect Collection in Canberra. Together, the researchers scanned through the collection of all longhorn beetle databases of Australia. Given the newfound beetle's distinct physical appearance, quote, we were pretty confident that this was a distinct genus and species, says Tweed, of the University of Queensland in Brisbane. Its proposed name is derived from the Latin words excastra, meaning, quote, from a camp, end quote, and albopilosa, meaning white and hairy. Tweed and colleagues remain uncertain about the exact function of the white hairs. If the fluff gives predators the impression that the beetle has a fungal infection, then that might reduce the insect's chances of getting eaten, or perhaps the hairs help the beetle regulate its body temperature. Discovering species that are new to science, Schildhuesen says, is a, quote, very satisfying feeling, end quote. Of the estimated 5 million insect species globally, researchers have named only about a million. The work is a way to, quote, at least safeguard yet another species, add it to the scientific literature, and make sure that somebody else recognizes it when they find it, he says. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Bill Shaw with Science News. I hope you have enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.